The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Within the first 100 days of becoming president in 1933, Franklin Delano Roosevelt passed 76 pieces of legislation. Compare that to John Kennedy's 26 or George W. Bush's 7. Barack Obama did slightly better than his predecessor, turning it up to 11. A far cry from the numbers in the first half of the 20th century. There's been a lot of talk about those first 100 days of a new administration. But for a country that feels like it's been in deadlock for years, how much can really be achieved in just over 3 months? And is it really a useful metric? Julia Azari is Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University and author of Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate. She wrote about why a president's first 100 days really do matter for 538. Julia, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
100 days seems like an arbitrary amount of time, though a nice round number. But you did find there is a demonstrable honeymoon effect during this period. What is the honeymoon effect?
The honeymoon effect is something presidential scholars like to talk about. That means the presidents have enjoy a little cushion of support from the public and from members of Congress in that early on in their presidency. And so sometimes this is marked by 3 months and sometimes it's marked by 100 days. You're right that pretty much all metrics are a little arbitrary in terms of when we cut them off. But it seems like over the course of the 20th century, this has been really concentrated in that late January, February, March, and through April. And that by the summer, it's usually gone.
The first 100 days, still important, but a lot less productive than in the days of FDR. What did he accomplish in those first 100 days?
Right. So FDR's first 100 days, the context is important here. So it's the Great Depression, and also FDR in 1933 was the last president to be inaugurated in March. So there was a really long period between when he was elected and when he actually took office, and Hoover was becoming less and less popular, and people were growing more and more frustrated during that time, and the crisis was very broad and very deep. So when FDR came in, among some of his accomplishments, this you see the creation of the modern social safety net, Social Security. Basically, immediately upon taking office, he unilaterally declared a national banking holiday and then reopened the banks. So there was some banking reform done in that time. For FDR, there was this kind of dual impetus to fix things immediately and kind of provide immediate relief for people, create jobs programs. Some of that also occurred in the first 100 days. But also, like I said, to really restructure the relationship between government and the economy. And so in the post-industrial economy in that context of the Depression. So that's the FDR story. And this 100 days, again, it sounds good. It's a round number. That's where that comes from.
Why the slump in productivity in those first 100 days since?
Well, I think there's a bunch of reasons for that. Some of the research by other people that I cite suggests that some of that has to do with reforms to the way Congress does business that basically give more people a say at the subcommittee level, kind of slows things down. Another reason I think that we see some of these more recent slumps are that it just takes a long time to build a coalition. When you don't have a crisis like the Great Depression, it takes a longer time to get all of the president's party together if there's unified control or to attract members from the other party, that just to get everybody together on a piece of legislation and agree on not just what the problem is and not just that something should be done in a kind of general direction, but those specifics, right? That is where legislation really becomes complex, is in what it's actually going to look like. Building a winning coalition takes, I think, a long time. And I think that accounts for the slump in productivity that we see among more recent presidents.
And when did we really start to see that?
So I mean, it kind of depends, right? There's a big drop off between FDR, the FDR Truman years, and then Eisenhower. So Eisenhower and Kennedy had legislative success in the, you know, the 20s. As you pointed out in the beginning, I think there is another kind of drop off. Bill Clinton, the number of bills is 24. George W. Bush, it's 7, and Obama, it's 11. That's not to say that's such a break with history, right? That's kind of actually right on par with Nixon and Reagan, but I think that we're likely to see that be a longer-term change where we don't see these just like huge numbers of bills coming out of Congress. And also, I should say, you know, those are raw numbers of how many laws, right? Not all laws are created equal, and so it's possible that we will see, to contradict what I just said, lots and lots of smaller bills coming out of an early Congress, but not so many of these signature proposals. That, I think, is really, the numbers don't show this, is really the key difference between George W. Bush and Barack Obama and their predecessors, is that their signature legislation came well after that 100 days.
So more coalition building needed, more layers of decision-making in the legislative process have slowed this down. Mm-hmm. But presidents can use executive action and executive powers.
Yes.
How have those been used by other presidents in these first 100 days?
Right. So again, that we see that varies. And that kind of peaked in the mid-20th century with Truman, Eisenhower, JFK, and Johnson. And it's kind of dropped off since, although it rose back up a bit with Obama with 19 of those. And I think some of that has to do with the content of the issues that are facing the president. A number of those executive orders in that mid-20th century period either have to do with labor policy and how labor policy is implemented or with civil rights. So JFK, for example, created an Equal Opportunity Office within the White House with an early executive order. Early executive orders, if you look at them, especially recently, have been very focused. This is true of other things that aren't called executive orders, memoranda, executive agreements with other countries. We're going to see a lot of that. These things now are very much focused on undoing the priorities of the predecessor and illustrating that sharp break with the past. That's not a totally new phenomenon in politics, but I think that how central it is a little bit new.
So given what the data says about the administrations, can those first 100 days really be a useful yardstick of how productive an administration will be?
A high number of bills probably suggests, okay, this is a unified government that's moving in, you know, in a particular kind of policy direction and whose priorities are clear, and whose priorities are clearly articulated by the president. On the other hand, I think the smaller number of bills with Bush and Obama kind of suggest this is a closely divided nation. This is a painstaking process of coalition building. And so even though I wouldn't say that either Bush or Obama, you know, really didn't get stuff done or wasn't legislatively productive, these are both very consequential presidencies, those low number of early bills tells us that neither of them was able to ride into town and tell everybody how it was going to be.
Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University and author of Delivering the People's Message. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Julia wrote the article, A President's First 100 Days Really Do Matter for 538. You'll find a link to read that story at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. For most of the last decade, the prevailing story for ski resorts here in the Northeast has been snow, or lack thereof, and questions of how resorts will cope with the warming climate in the decades to come. As time passes, many mountains will face another problem, aging ski lifts. Brendan Burrell is a correspondent for Outside Magazine, where he reported that some two-thirds of chairlifts around the country are more than 20 years old, and nearly 100 of those were installed more than half a century ago. Brendan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the ski industry had its first fatality, chairlift fatality, in 24 years this winter. That was specifically due to electrical or mechanical problems. So what happened and where?
That was at this Granby ski resort in Colorado. A real tragedy. Basically, a 40-year-old woman from Texas and her two daughters were riding up a lift called the Quick Draw Express, and the lift suddenly jerked forward, and it flung her and her daughters against a pole or a sign, and they fell off the lift, and the mother died, and one of the daughters was life-lighted and must be in serious condition. So an accident like that has not happened in many decades, and it's a real tragedy.
It is. It's terrible. But how are chairlifts maintained and regulated? Who's in charge of that?
Well, it's a real patchwork. It depends on where you live exactly. Some states have oversight boards, potentially. In Vermont, for instance, there is a specific tramway board that oversees chairlifts. In other states, it might be, say, a agency tasked with overseeing amusement park rides. And a lot of places out west, there isn't any specific oversight. And so the ski lifts rely upon, say, the insurance companies that are insuring their ski lifts will send out an inspector. And many of them follow a set of voluntary standards that the industry has developed over the last 50 years.
I didn't realize that there's actually a New Hampshire connection here, that one of the first accidents to spur industry standards happened right here in New Hampshire.
That's right. I think it was up at Gunstock Mountain in the 1950s. There was a real tragic accident. One of the chairlift cables snapped, and it killed a person and injured several others. And this was kind of this period when, you know, there was a free-for-all. The U.S. had been developing ski areas at this rapid pace, and they were just stringing up chairlifts all over the mountain. And, you know, you'd call in a local engineer, and they sort of were figuring things out on their own, and there weren't any national standards or guidelines about how to actually string a chairlift on a mountain. And so that accident was a wake-up call, and a bunch of members of industry got together, and they started drafting a code, and this code has sort of been updated every 5 or 10 years, I believe, as, you know, with advances in technology and our knowledge of how to make ski areas safer. But that's kind of the guideline, the Bible, if you will, for maintaining and operating ski lifts safely.
Well, what are the biggest concerns for an aging ski lift? I mean, something mechanical can last for years if maintained properly, right?
Oh, that's right. I mean, we have bridges. I mean, this is a massive piece of infrastructure, like a bridge or a highway overpass. And parts of it are going to last a really, really long time, whereas other parts might wear out more quickly. So I think the industry is very quick to say that you can't say that a chairlift is too old, because it's actually, you know, the parts are constantly changing. It's like if you have an old car and, you know, you replace the radiator and you replace the tires, you can keep the thing going and you can keep it going safely. But you have to be really careful about it, and you have to be checking things and being diligent in replacing parts after their estimated lifespan. So a lot of the mechanical parts that are moving, those are easy to test and watch out for, wearing on the gears. What some of the sources I talked to told me were some of the big concerns for the future is the aging of the metal itself, the fatiguing of the lift poles, because this is something that big ski resorts have the kind of tools to be able to test the integrity of the metal and so on. But that's actually something that smaller ski resorts struggle with, and it's pretty expensive to get somebody in there to check all this stuff.
Yeah, a lot of the smaller ski mountains around here seems like they're barely keeping their doors open as it is, but there have been some warnings. There's a company that comes up a few times in your article. It's called Borvig, a lift manufacturer which closed its door back in the 90s. Now, how does this company factor in?
That's right. I mean, so they many of the lifts out east are were manufactured by Borvig, which was one of the major companies. And there was a recent accident in West Virginia last February where the arm of one of the lifts, so basically you have a pole and then an arm that comes out with the wheels on it, and the chairlift cable rides on those wheels. And that lift arm snapped while there were people on it. Nobody was killed. but there were some injuries. And it was just a scary thing to happen. I mean, it was a very, you know, it's the last thing you want to happen is to be sitting on a lift and suddenly feel yourself falling, right? Part of the issue with that, you know, it wasn't that the lift was necessarily that the company, you know, had failed. And in fact, what happened was about 25 years ago, the company had sent out a warning to ski areas to say, hey, actually, you know, we're noticing some cracks developing on the arm. Here is a part. It was a type of bolt. You need to add this part to your lift. Well, lo and behold, this ski area, according to the people I talked to, never added that bolt. And, you know, and here we are 25 years later and the thing snapped. And so I think that sort of draws attention to the fact that, you know, these older parts and the record keeping at some resorts may not be up to par. You're also relying upon the skill of the mechanics you hire. And that was a second problem that I discovered, which is that a lot of the guys working at ski areas are younger these days. You know, many of the old season employees have retired and moved on. And so the younger guys might not be as familiar with these old lifts and how, you know, in their entire life, like I said, the parts changing out, what they learned along the way. And so this is definitely a second challenge.
Brenda Burrell is with us. He's a correspondent for Outside Magazine, where he reported on the aging chairlifts at ski areas around the country. Nearly 100 of them in the country are more than half a century old and badly in need of repair. Brendan, how are accidents on chairlifts reported?
Well, there's no national sort of governmental tally of chairlift accidents. So again, this is a state-by-state thing. And the other way that accidents are tallied is the National Ski Areas Association. They keep sort of a track of some of the accidents and incidents that have occurred, but it's in no way comprehensive. As I discovered during my reporting, you know, they have a list. I think they said there had been 73 injuries since 1973, but when I started looking, I found an additional injury that they hadn't marked down. So that's kind of, you know, it's great that they're keeping track. I think that's a really important thing for the industry to do, and it shows transparency. But at the same time, it would be really great if the government was keeping track of these statistics. And I just want to emphasize that, you know, focusing on the negative is, of course, very dangerous. There have been incredibly few accidents from mechanical failures. Most of the time when you go skiing, the biggest risk is other skiers or your own failure to stop or hit an obstacle. And so the lift malfunctions are actually pretty low down on the list. I think the reason that it's important is because this is the point during your day when you are a passive participant and you're, you know, completely handing off your safety to the ski resort. And so even though it's a very slim risk and, you know, you shouldn't be so scared about hopping on a chairlift, I think it's important that, you know, the ski lifts take that responsibility seriously.
What is actually keeping mountains from updating their lifts? Is it just the cost?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the lift mechanics I spoke to were passionate about what they did, and they love skiing, and they don't want anybody to get hurt on the mountain. But they're always butting up against cost. 30 years ago, it cost about $200,000, $300,000 to install a new lift. Today, it's like $1 to $2 million. So the costs have soared. And so ski areas, especially smaller ones, you know, not every ski hill is a Vail or an Aspen. They've got to make do with what they have. And they're going to try to keep repairing things and keeping them going for as long as possible.
So if somebody's going, planning a day of skiing, is there any place to check on the age or condition of the ski lift?
Unfortunately, there's not. That's what I found is, you know, potentially there are some websites where you can look at the age of a lift. But again, I think the best thing to do is just kind of to give it the smell test where, you know, does your resort seem like they're maintaining the lodge? Are the ski poles looking rusty? What I'd heard was in West Virginia that, you know, there was a bad paint job on the ski poles. It was looking pretty ratty. But other than that, making sure that the operation is professional, I think it's a challenge. I don't think that most skiers or consumers are equipped to judge a piece of equipment like that. I mean, when you drive across a highway overpass, how do you know if it's safe? And we know, we've seen the government reports that our nation's infrastructure is failing. But we require, you know, that's why this issue demands regulatory oversight.
Brendan Burrell, correspondent for Outside Magazine, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You can find a link to Brendan's article on aging chairlifts at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Ellis Ludwig Leon was deep into studying composition at Yale when he started playing around, integrating pop tunes with orchestral arrangements. He finished school and retreated to the proverbial woodshed to compose what would become San Fermin, a sleeper indie hit in 2013. NPR named it one of the most surprising, ambitious, evocative, and moving records of the year. Loads of critics and fans joined in, and after a lot of touring, another album, and a few personnel changes, San Fermin's new album, Belong, is due out in April. We're listening to the track, Open. The chamber pop band San Fermin is among a number of bands, including Bombino and Salif Keita, at Crash Fest at the House of Blues in Boston this Saturday. We wanted to catch up with the band leader, pianist, and composer Ellis Ludwig Leon first. Ellis, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So your work used to be played at concert halls and now in rock clubs. Did you ever imagine that when you were studying composition?
I always had a band on the side. And I used to play, you know, little shows in places at Yale, cafeterias, things like that, basically anywhere that would have us. So I had a sense that maybe that would happen, but it has been shocking how quickly we've kind of migrated to rock clubs all the time.
Well, it's also in this record, you write about a shift in perspective. You used to write more about characters from films or books, and now you're writing more about yourself. What is yourself in these songs?
You know, I think when I started writing songs, I had a lot of trouble when I tried to write from the first person. I felt like I would always end up saying stuff that felt overblown or grandiose or kind of just stupid. So it helped me to write from the perspective of, you know, other characters from books and movies and things like that. But, you know, as I've gone on, and this is now my third record, I feel like I've gotten a lot more confident writing just from my own perspective. So I think these songs are a little more personal maybe than the ones in the past.
Well, let's hear a little from one of those songs, Bride. First, tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, this song is based on a story that happened to me. Where it's about basically a dissociative moment, a panic attack at a wedding. But the song is imagined from the perspective of the bride, which I obviously was not.
Let's hear it. Not exactly it is the picture-perfect wedding moment until she's just checked out.
Yeah, well, I always found that weddings particularly are such a strange experience for me, because it's like there's so much pressure on them to be this perfect experience. There's so much money and so much sort of, expectation and hope behind it. And those are traditionally the kinds of experiences that often make me the most anxious.
I wonder about that anxiety. You're a band leader who really isn't out front of your band. Is anxiety behind that? You prefer to kind of linger back?
Maybe less that. I mean, I've never quite had stage fright in the way that, you know, I've heard other performers talk about it. I think more it's the fact that, you know, I have never particularly liked my singing voice. And I get to work with two singers, with Alan and Charlene, who have such great voices. And I realized that, you know, pretty early on, I realized that the way this band would work the best is if it was an opportunity for all the musicians to really feel showcased. I'm obviously writing the songs and doing the interviews and things like that, and I'm perfectly happy to feed the spotlight to better instrumentalists and better singers and musicians, you know, when we actually get on stage.
You mentioned Alan and Charlene, Alan Tate and Charlene Kay. They were both on your previous album, Jackrabbit. But San Fermín, through the years, has worked with a couple of different singers, both of the women in Lucius, Ray Cassidy. So when you are composing, are you hearing specific voices?
I don't mean voices.
Do you hear voices?
Yes, I'm hearing voices. Yeah, no, I Alan and I have worked together since we were basically 15. And, you know, it's at the point now where when I write a song for him, I mean, I literally can hear his voice saying the words. You know, I know his voice so well. And Charlene joined the band over 2 years ago now. And so, you know, I think this record is, even though she sang on Jackrabbit, I feel like this record is the one where I really was getting to know her voice and where she sounds the best and what she likes to do. And, you know, hopefully that really comes through.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Alan Tate singing the song Bones.
These are just the bones telling me what everyone knows. We are not alone. Love. If I could take you home, the bodies tell the rest of the story. Maybe we resolve ourselves. Honey, you should know there's two of me at play. One will turn to go and one will turn away. And I know we've got decisions to make.
That's the song Bones from the new album called Belong from the Baroque pop band San Fermín. We're getting a little preview of that new album that's coming out in April with Ellis Ludwig Leon. He's a band leader and composer for the band, and they're playing Crash Fest in Boston this weekend. I did read that the first album was composed pretty much at Banff, you know, way out in the Canadian wilds. But since then, there's been a lot of touring, a lot of life on the road. Are you able to compose with all that motion going on around you?
You know, I can write on the road. I wrote the song Emily on the last record and a couple other ones I wrote when we were on the road. But I generally try to reserve writing for when I'm home, or at least not traveling, you know, because I think the way that I like to write, it's, you know, I write for all the instruments at once. I don't do that. I don't really sit at a piano and just play chords and sing. So because that's the case, I often need my gear and my studio and also just a little bit of mental space. I would say basically, you know, I try to make sure when we're scheduling our tours that there's, you know, a month here and there that have breaks. And when I wrote a lot of Belong, actually, was after we had finished the year and a half of touring on the last record. And I came home and basically had, you know, a month to do nothing except for write and think. And, you know, my girlfriend was gone for the month, and it was just basically just me in a house feeling kind of weird. So I always find that that's kind of the best way to start.
So we get the smooth R&B song, and we also get the song No Promises, which is kind of a more vulnerable and I think maybe more realistic love song.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, I suppose it's a love song in its own way. I wrote that song basically to my bandmates. That song is about, yeah, you know, it's weird. We've been playing, you know, shows for 3 years. You know, people are getting a little older, and it's basically about the fear that I have that they've entrusted me with, you know, their lives in a way that I might not, you know, be ready for or be able to lead them to what they want. So the song is basically saying, you know, hey, thanks for sticking with me. I wouldn't blame you if you didn't. So it's kind of the general gist there.
All right, let's hear I Won't Promise You. And Ellis Ludwig Leon, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Ellis Ludwig Leon, he's bandleader and composer for the chamber pop band San Fermin. We're listening to the song No Promises from the new album called Belong, which is out in April. You can hear and see a video for the song Bride from the new album and find more on Crash Fest. That's a packed night of music. Salif Keita, Dabi Touré, and the Touareg guitarist Bombino. And you can hear our interview about Bombino. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Jazar, Poddington Bear, San Fermin, and Ye Ye. We'd like to share some wonderful news today. Our sister podcast, Civics 101, which is kind of a refresher course on the high school and middle school things we were supposed to learn about the fundamentals of democracy, has been chosen by iTunes as a new and noteworthy podcast. It is now climbing up the charts and at number 42. It's out of zillions of podcasts. So the more people who listen to it, and especially those who leave a review, the higher it can climb. So you can have a real effect right now in helping our little podcast from our little state of New Hampshire create a more informed citizenry. That's the power of word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.